This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Double Take, a discussion with filmmaker Juhan Grimon-Prez, writer Tom McCarthy, and psychoanalyst Jameson Webster on Grimon-Prez's 2009 film of the same title. It took place on April 22nd, 2011.
So a little word to contextualize the film, because it's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of like sub-stories. So the point of departure of the film was that we were looking for a Hitchcock doubleganger for another film that still has to be made. And so we set out for a casting in L.A. and in New York and in London. And then in London, we stumbled onto this Ron Burridge, which is a professional Hitchcock doubleganger who's been playing Hitchcock and staging Hitchcock for like 20 years. And I thought, well, here's a peculiar character. In profile, he looked very much like Hitchcock. So I thought he could function as a Hitchcock doubleganger. But when I started talking to him, apparently so many things, the story got weirder and weirder, because first of all, he was born on the same day as Hitchcock, the 13th of August. Then he told me his life story, that when he was 14, he started as a lift boy working at the Claridge's Hotel, where Hitchcock's used to stay whenever he came over from Hollywood. And then he went on to work for the Savoy restaurant as a waiter, where actually Hitchcock used to dine. It was Hitchcock's favorite restaurant in London. And here we had Ron Burridge at the other end of the spectrum, serving the likes of Cary Grant, James Stewart, Lauren Hardy, the very likes that people used to work with on the set. And then the story became stranger and stranger and stranger, up to like, well, and Hitchcock died, he took on, because that's the story also in the film, he took on the role of Hitchcock doubleganger when Hitchcock died. And so he made sort of full circle when in 1999, with the centennial of Hitchcock, he was asked to introduce the restored version, a doubleganger of the Birds, the restored version of the Birds, to the audience in the very act of being Hitchcock and introducing the protagonist of the Birds, Tippi Hedren, for a big audience. And so that was sort of full circle. And I thought, wow, here's an interesting story as a hook to make a film around. So that's sort of the basis. Then I invited Tom to work on the project as the writer. And we sort of set off of rewriting the Borges story, where Borges meets himself. And sort of we came up with the story where Hitchcock meets Hitchcock. And sort of that's the story that takes you through the film. But it's set in 1962, when Truffaut met Hitchcock on the set of The Birds, where they started off this dialogue that led into the big chunky book of the Hitchcock interviews, Hitchcock-Truffaut interviews. And that dialogue sort of was the basis, together with the Borges story, where Borges meets himself, his doubleganger, as sort of building the story through that period of the 60s, which is also the rise of television and sort of where Hollywood had to redefine itself vis-a-vis television. And so there's the rise of television through that sort of staging of the space race, and also the Cold War as sort of the beginning and inception of the culture of fear. And that's sort of the backdrop of the film, where the film doubles the intimate story of Hitchcock versus Hitchcock. So that's about it to contextualize. We can like pick up on the story, and there's the symposium afterward. But one little thing, Hitchcock used to say that a film should last as long as the endurance of the human bladder. And I would say, maybe, you know, if you want to run out, do that. But if you make it all the way to the very end of the film and to the credits, stay a little bit longer, because we had so much material that we actually had to put the climax at after the credits. No, but it's a joke. But there's a little epilogue, so stay a little bit seated. I would ask to keep the lights dimmed till we have Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld is the very end character of this film. So enjoy, and then we have a symposium afterwards.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jameson Webster. I'm here again with Tom McCarthy and Juhan Grimon-Prez. I'd just like to start the conversation by having you tell us the backstory. There's a lot of wonderful stories folded into the making of this movie that I've learned about in talking with Tom and Juhan over the last week. The first of which that I was surprised to find out, which is the reason that it's dedicated in the end to Ron Burridge, is that he dies during the final editing of the movie. So there's a sort of doubling story, which is that your film is essentially murderous.
Yeah, I'm actually afraid to make movies when I made Dial History. 9/11 happened. Dial History is actually about the chronology of airplane hijacking. When the film came out, 2 years later, 3 years later, 9/11 happened. And so when we had the story about a double ganger killing his double, then Ron. But I knew Ron was sick, but he died actually when we finalized the film. And yes, so I could not but dedicate it to Ron because he's a lovely person. But he is in spirit. He's there. I wasn't dear to see him again in the kitchen making me myself a cup of coffee.
And the other fascinating double to this event is that your father is in fact a Hitchcock double himself.
All right, we can have a whole Freudian take on this, parenticide. And also Hitchcock, in a sense, is a bit the father of cinema, right? But it's true. We had first this Hitchcock casting for another project, which was sort of a project that led into the bigger film, Looking for Alfred, which was a five-minute sort of loop, a little project where Hitchcock meets Hitchcock. Hitchcock walks around the block, loses his head, sees himself losing his head, walks around the block, sees him seeing himself. And one of those Hitchcock is actually my dad, and he's also in the film, but you don't see his face. But in a sense, yeah. When I always tell the story, when I was a 7-year-old kid, I found this book in the bookshelves of my dad, and on the cover was this guy who looked like my dad, like double chin and balding, and I thought, wow, this is peculiar. And that I didn't know at the time, but that was my first confrontation or my first contact with Hitchcock. Actually,
was it uncanny to see this picture?
Well, at the time, it was just okay. Yeah. I remember that like now, a long time ago, because I remember that book. And so I remember also thinking, this is sort of funny, and why is my dad such a fan of Hitchcock? And this is all conflated and stuff like that. But the uncanny is interesting to talk about, because Hitchcock, in his essay, The Uncanny, says also that actually meeting your double is this opening up of where the real confronts you, and it's part of the uncanny. It's a symptom of the uncanny. Mm-hmm. But also Tom was my double ganger in making this film.
The conditions under which you met were both around the question of terrorism and art and doubling and the search for origins and originality and repetition. Maybe you could talk about that.
Well, I guess we'd both... I didn't say this. We'd both made these. You'd made the film and Dial History, and I'd written this novel that also ends in an airline hijack, and it kind of revolves around terror and aesthetics and doubling and repetition. And then there was a screening of the film at the British Film Institute, and there was a discussion afterwards. And I really loved this film. I thought it was fantastic. And the other panelists were quite critical, right? They didn't feel it was kind of basically on the right side.
We didn't render ideology as ideology.
That's right. Ideology has to be rendered as ideology, and anyhow, we kind of connected over that. And then you had this. Johan had this. The shorter project you were talking about, Looking for Alfred, and then you found this Borges story where Borges meets Borges that he actually wrote twice.
He wrote the story twice too. Yeah.
So I just kind of looked at it, and then we reimagined Hitchcock meeting Hitchcock initially on the Topaz set, right in the airport.
Exactly, yeah. And then you rewrote it as actually the set of the birds. But when I was at that talk in London, I thought it was interesting the way you described sort of, but that was more like the narrative of the hijacking, sort of dramatic triangle, that sort of the hijack and the media and the hijacked, the passengers were sort of caught up in a dramatic triangle, and I thought, that's sort of interesting of an analysis to talk about news media, sort of this fiction story that is sort of projected onto this narrative of news footage, and I thought, And then I read Tom's book, Remainder, which actually indeed is the protagonist suffers from amnesia where he sort of doubles his life, right? He's trying to recreate a double of what he doesn't know yet. It's the unknown.
The unknown.
the unknown. Unknown.
And
unknown.
So that was sort of an inspiration for this film. So we went back and forth. So in a sense, we were a little bit of double gangers, image and text and sort of this is not a pipe sort of thing, the subtitle.
So then how is the process of working together?
It was great. We had these long working lunches.
Sure.
We'd always eat really well. That's what I remember most. I mean, we'd meet about once every kind of 7 months or something, and spend a few days together, and then go for it. And then I'd go back to London, and Johan would spend the next 7 months working full out on it, and then I'd kind of drop in again 7 months later over about 3 years.
Right. Yeah. So I would say there's a lot of coffee cups and teacups that went over the dialogue, during the dialogue. And indeed, it was back and forth. So I would layer sort of a rough cut and then send it to Tom with a voice that was not yet a final voice, but just to try out. Because the first story you wrote, it was the first version that was based on the other of Borges, that I used to elaborate the sort of the story. And the basis of the film started with actually layering the voice and then over that actually adding images. But at the time, the political picture was not so much there. So when I invited Tom for another session, and we had... then we had a little blip of the kitchen debate that sort of fit very well. And then Tom said, hey, but, you know, I think we have another double here. It's sort of a mirror of the very intimate dialogue. And we started talking about that. And bit by bit, it sort of grew also that kitchen debate fell into place and became part of how that intimate dialogue of Hitchcock meeting Hitchcock and trying to get rid of the other was sort of mirrored and played out through the political period of that time, which literally the world was on the brink of nuclear holocaust. And it was the first confrontation between East and West as well. And sort of communism and capitalism became also those double gangs. But that literally fled out of the dialogue we had. I remember also... Tom's suggestion, why don't you take Ramsfeld, you know, you should look at that. Look at that footage on YouTube. And then that was his suggestion, actually.
But I think the whole thing, this really comes through in Dial History as well, that this sense that media is even overarching it's bigger than either side. You know, when Hitchcock asks Hitchcock, when the young one asks the old one, who wins the Cold War, the old one just waves it away. It's a trivial question because media wins, you know. And this idea, I remember you talking about...
History
had this idea
doesn't win? He says history,
media, the
history
spectacle
is going to overtake you, the spectacle.
But the spectacle. I mean, and I remember you saying that, you know, that shot when the birds come in on the town, it's the same as the TV image kind of coming into your living room through the fireplace, through the kind of opening that media itself kind of carries terror, you know, carries the violence, carries murder into the home where it always belongs.
Right. Well, there is this analogy of catastrophic culture invading the home, trapping people in front of the television as birds in a cage. And it's true, the birds became that metaphor, although there's a couple of Hitchcock scholars who would absolutely not... Is this sort of working? Hitchcock scholars would not necessarily agree, but working through the time period of 1962... And those big television moments, it's sort of where television came of age as well, that Hollywood had to redefine itself. A lot of cinema theaters were closing down, so there was a big shift there, sort of the status of the image. And it's also the moment when Hitchcock chose to cross over to television. Mm-hmm. And that's what interests me, that you have this Hollywood icon, which is measured on by the lookalike as well, but how he actually played also that medium of television. And I thought it was interesting at a moment where he had the biggest television moments, the presidential debate where Kennedy was literally the first television president. Then the space race, of course, but also the moment at 7 p.m. on the 22nd of October when Kennedy announced that there was missiles stationed in Cuba, was also the biggest television audience in the United States. And then when Kennedy was shot, his funeral was actually worldwide the biggest audience, the television audience. So these are big television moments where, for the first time, the world was united around this sort of catastrophes or mini-catastrophes. And the birds sort of are pivotal because 1962, and it came out in 1963, with that sort of conflation and the coincidence of that letter that was sent by Kennedy to Hitchcock, which I thought was a weird coincidence, but it sets the period of the time where television is on the rise and sort of those commercials sort of, or that landscape that sort of is so characteristic for television that Hitchcock always used to be upset with and always joked about. And I don't know, I keep on talking, but maybe
this question of orchestrating your own death that you bring up towards the end of the dialogue between them, as if they're going to outrun death, and then the way that circulates obviously in the political story. And that's obviously themes in your work.
I think there's a big kind of literary back history of doubles, obviously, like through Jekyll and Hyde and Frankenstein and Dostoevsky and...
Conrad,
yeah, The Secret Sharer. I mean, loads of his works. Heart of Darkness is kind of a doubling story. And always, it seems to me, it's always, death is always at stake. I mean, especially in Frankenstein, he's constructing his own death, kind of, I mean, as dead. Its precondition is that it's dead. You know.
Johan and I were talking before about whether you have to kill your double. Right, you start your text saying, if you meet your double, you must kill him or he'll kill you. I don't remember which, to be honest. And you were saying that you think that maybe
it depends, right? You have to look at every example in particular. Because, for example, when you talk about the uncanny, where Freud analyzed that, the fact that not coming to terms with your own sort of narcissism, that actually that double that comes to break to the fabric of the real actually could also mean that if you kill that double, you can actually open up that dialogue with the woman, mm-hmm. or something. Or mm-hmm. that's what happens also with Hitchcock, who's always facing his double, and it's an act that comes back all the time. The wrong man, vertigo.
That's not murder, that's suicide.
That's male hysteria. It's the man caught in his own sort of world where he can't see the desire of the woman. So that's one thing. But yeah, before the film, we were talking about the fact that, you know, when I look at the film and researching the film politically, I thought, okay, Kennedy came to power by projecting that fear, the fear of the other, and sort of provoking that we have to kill that double, which is the communism, which is the, you know, embodied by Khrushchev, and the same vice versa. Because also those parades in Moscow, they were empty parades, right? Because those missiles were empty. It was a masquerade, of course. This was all a masquerade to actually win power and win television viewers.
They were MacGuffins, right?
They were MacGuffins. Yeah, and what if the Cold War is not like a long, painful MacGuffin? And it's sort of that emptiness, it's a masquerade. But at the end...
the invasion of Iraq, right? The weapons of mass destruction.
I can come to that, which is the unknown knowns that Zizek refers to, that the idiom that Zizek forgot. But when I worked through the material, I thought, hey, here we have Kennedy bit by bit. They had that sort of diplomatic meeting in Vienna, and that was a disaster because afterwards then the Berlin Wall was built, which actually Kennedy, not a lot of people know that, but Kennedy actually welcomed the wall, despite all the rhetorics that he actually put or staged in Berlin. But for him, it was a stabilization. But towards the progression and his sort of... presidency, he became aware that actually he wanted to open up that diplomatic gap. Mm-hmm. You know, he wanted to have a dialogue, and he didn't want to buy into that fear. And sort of that's where maybe the third partner comes in, where, mm-hmm. you know, and that's sort of the treachery in the film. It's not clearly laid out, but it's there underneath.
I think it's there in humor in the film, because there's moments that are incredibly funny, and it breaks a lot of the tension that you feel.
But I would have loved to also, I don't know, there sometimes I think, maybe there's where the film fails, or, you know, for example, that Kennedy was resolutely against Israel having the bomb, and Khrushchev was resolutely against having China the bomb. Mm-hmm. And so, we don't want to get into conspiracy, we can, but about why Kennedy was shot and stuff. But
they were both killed domestically, is the point.
Exactly,
right?
I mean, because... Yeah. Yeah, when Khrushchev was dethroned, 2 days later, Mao exploded the first nuclear bomb. And there was a diplomatic dialogue by correspondence between Kennedy and Khrushchev that really they were trying to push for, and that's hence also the first nuclear treaty, which was just 1 month before Kennedy was shot. So there is sort of something to say about, you know, you don't necessarily have to kill your double. You could open up a diplomatic channel, which also, that's why the nuclear holocaust with the Cuban Missile Crisis didn't happen. Keep on talking. But you had a story about you meeting your double.
It's true. In typical psychoanalytic fashion, I had a dream to prepare for this panel. And so just to give you the backstory of the dream, the reason that Tom had asked me to do this was that we had a long conversation one night over drinks in a bar about doubles and rivals. And I told him that I had... in fact, a rival who shares my name. Her name is, I won't reveal it, but her last name is Webster. And we had a long rivalry, and I told him that I don't know whether I became a Lacanian psychoanalyst on my own volition. I think that it was actually because she was interested in Lacanian psychoanalysis. And that I really think that this is where my interest in it started. And in fact, she had a jouissance tattooed on her arm. And because she found out that I had become a psychoanalyst, she was having it erased at the time, and a friend of ours told her that, in fact, it now looked like it said Jameson. And so, you know, I think just because this was on my mind, I was thinking about the movie, and I had just watched it over the weekend. I had a dream that she was facing me, and the more that she imitated everything that I was doing, the more that I was stripped of my sense of who I was and my autonomy and my sense of originality. And you just find yourself utterly foolish. You know, nothing that you can do can remain your own. And I think that that's what I took away both from your narrative and your movie, this very sort of powerful message about what doubling is about.
They use those terms that they talk about, you know, your face is a parody of mine and yeah. Your voice is a mimicry. And
I hate it.
And I hate it. Yeah, it's completely voiding them out. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also it's, again, two guys making a film while there's all these guys doing the talking about their rockets. Then there's the kitchen debate. There's the kitchen debate in big on a political level. But then there's the kitchen debate in a domestic level that actually is the repressed sort of underside of the bigger political picture. But again, there's the two guys that make a film that probably have to go into therapy. No, I'm kidding. But it's funny that, you know, of course, it's that double is also has to do with desire and mm-hmm. sort of things that are repressed and that peek through the fabric of the real.
Each time I see this film again, I see how, like, totally erotic it is. You know, there's so much, and it's homoerotic. It's always, I mean, okay, there's the husband-wife stuff, but they're not doing it. That's the whole point, because the coffee's bad. But there are loads of men kissing men and women kissing women throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of kind of erotics in it, which is also in all the literature of double, especially Conrad that you mentioned. It's completely homoerotic, you know. They would have to kill each other, otherwise they'd kind of screw each other. You know, it's one or the other. Seems that,
Should we take questions from the audience? Any questions?
What happens now television is dead?
Say that again?
What happens now television is dead?
Oh, all right. That's actually a very good question and pertinent question, because for me, there is three sort of meetings in this film. One is 1962, 1980, and then 2001. And for me, Ron Burridge, who's the lookalike, embodies sort of this YouTubeization of the world. And a lot of clips of this film come actually from YouTube, the whole research and the way it was set up and staged. So a lot of stuff that came from YouTube amongst Rumsfeld, but also the whole Gagarin stuff. And I would say the fact that, you know, we know Hitchcock firsthand. Me, even, I never saw, I only saw two films of Hitchcock in the cinema. I know it from television. I'm a kid from the television generation. But this film was clearly made after 9/11. I don't know if people have seen it, but for me, Double Take is also a double take on dial history, which is about, you know, where 9/11 confirmed dial history. I sort of had to come to terms with that. And it's sort of what Zizek would talk about of how it's the return of the repressed as a lookalike. The real comes back to haunt us as a lookalike, because all those images of 9/11 were already out there in the world. Hollywood was actually running ahead of reality, because this world is so stacked and abundant with images through YouTube and you name it, that actually 9/11, as if we sort of felt it was like a deja vu. It was sort of a double take. And sort of Zizek would argue that it's sort of the real comes back to haunt us as a lookalike. And for me, it's sort of what's going on with the YouTubeization of the world. It's also the weapons of mass destruction, because we live in a Photoshop reality. It's sort of this Photoshop. And what they say of, like, when we have 2006, you know, about 6,000 clips are loaded up a day on YouTube only. And it's sort of that... it's what they call, like, Web 2.0 is sort of the imitation culture. It's lookalike culture. It's, you have all these little clips that people now... It's now, you know, not anymore one too many, like television was one too many, it's now many too many. It's sort of the prosumers, but the prosumers sort of imitate that big monoculture still and never puts it on YouTube, and nobody even questions that you actually submit your clips to a big corporation, and it's sort of many too many, but it disguises itself as something else. It's this Photoshop reality, which is the weapons of mass destruction, which Zizek would call the unknown knowns, which is the fourth idiom. And I would say this film was for me very much trying to come to terms with that. And YouTube is there because it's Hitchcock as the clone. It's not Hitchcock. It's not a film about Hitchcock. It's a film about a Hitchcock lookalike, or how Hitchcock has been doubled and multiplied, and how a younger generation, like, looks at that, it's Thomas Elsesser who said he would actually be here. He wrote about the fact that every other month there's another book being published on Hitchcock, and Zizou calls it sort of the big mirror. It's a big referent. It's sort of the primal scene is Hitchcock of cinema, and it's sort of cinema status collapses under its own weight of Hitchcock, because you know there's so much being published on Hitchcock, and Thomas Elsesser goes on to say, oh, we have a Freudian Hitchcock, a Lacanian Hitchcock, a feminist Hitchcock, a Wittgensteinian Hitchcock, a Nietzschean Hitchcock, and go on and on, and everybody has his own little Hitchcock. We all have their own little Hitchcock, just as sort of what James Joyce would be for literature or Mozart for music. It's sort of that doubling that actually is an accepted vocabulary that is so out there, but that we keep on doubling. And that's what society has become. And 9/11 was a pivotal moment in that. That 9/11 was sort of a thing that avant la lettre, that thing that was already out there as a symptom of the repressed unconscious to come back to haunt America, because America is not coming to terms with its own double, because it's disseminating that double, and it doesn't want to look at its own sort of oppression of the world, and sort of through the fabric of the real 9/11 comes back to haunt America.
Didn't Noam Chomsky say those weren't aeroplanes, they were birds coming home to roost?
Amongst another one. Actually, there's a funny anecdote.
Pigeons coming home to roost.
There is the film, actually. Do you remember that? The film started actually with an anecdote. In 1948, hundreds of birds flew into the Empire State. And that was 9/11. So on 12 September 1948, the New York Times, you can look it up on the front page, it mentioned hundreds of birds, hundreds of bodies littered Fifth Avenue, that hundreds of birds crashed into the Empire State. It was 9/11, which was reported on 12 September. Mm-hmm. Now, last year, during the celebration of 11 September, when the ceremonial lights were up, like the monument of the light cones that actually embodied the World Trade Center, hundreds of birds got caught again on 11 September, and it was reported in the news. So there is this conflation of the birds, coincidence, or I don't know, but these are things that I'd like to pick up on, and it's that coincidence of Ron Burge being born on the same day. And you know, the birthday of Castro is 13th of August, by the way. Anyway.
Any more questions?
That's an answer.
Yes, that's an answer. Any more questions? I just want to ask one last thing. Can you tell us about the Folgers commercials? It's one of my favorite parts of the...
Well, the DVD in Belgium and in France is coming out with 50 extra Folgers commercials.
All right.
Then you might be very happy.
Something that's not in that movie, though, is that the Folger heiress was one of the first Manson family victims as well. She was with Sharon Tate. Mm. In the house and was murdered on that first night of yes, another weird.
But then I probably wouldn't have gotten the okay of the Folgers company.
They let you. They let you. You had to get their permission, because you cut from that to him saying poison or very nasty. I mean, I'm quite. Did that? They didn't vet it. They just said, have it, because they still exist. They still market.
Right. And
it's quite defamatory.
But we had a little bit of luck. It's true. We first had toothpaste commercials, actually. The commercials that I really found. A Hitchcock scholar had sent me all the footage of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents with commercials including. But then I saw one of the Folgers, and I thought, that's interesting. And we worked a plot around the fact that actually the coffee became the murder weapon. In a sense, it's a Folgers.
Like in Notorious, the Hitchcock movie where they're murdering the wife.
Exactly.
With
There's actually a funny anecdote that didn't make it into the film. Is Ron Burge, at one point, he was serving in first class and came face-to-face with Ingrid Bergman, asking him for a cup of coffee. And I thought, but it didn't make any difference. We had to cut a lot of things. But he did meet Ingrid Bergman and serving her a cup of coffee in first class. But what happened is that at one point you said, let's write to Folgers. And they sent, not Folgers itself, but Folgers was working with Saatchi and Saatchi. And so Saatchi actually owns the rights to all the commercials. And they send us all the footage. And then while we were editing the film, this was actually a happy accident that the Folgers, Saatchi and Saatchi went over to another, they had to, well, there was the company Folgers was sold, and then Saatchi also had to delegate it to another company. In the meantime, they had given their okay that we could use it in the context of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, so we could do what they said. We wouldn't touch that okay, so I mean, we didn't have to pay for it. We had a free, but it's free commercials for them. So it's like, but it's true that it's actually the commercial which turns into the weapon, the mm-hmm. murder weapon, mm-hmm. and Hitchcock played on that angle a lot as well, and it's sort of.
And you had already written that the coffee was gonna be poisoned.
I can't, you know, I can't even remember what I wrote and what I didn't. I mean, from that, seriously, I mean, what we, some of it has just come straight from the Borges story, and some of it is Hitchcock speaking, mm-hmm. and I've just lost track. It was cut, and we, you know, over the 2-3 years we were working together, so much of it got changed and shifted that I've forgotten what
was original.
What was original.
But it was there in the first little Looking for Alfred film as well. When you,
it was the coffee.
We met actually 4 or 5 years before, where we talked through the whole, no, 3-4 years before, where we talked through the whole narrative. And for a book, there was a first version that actually had coffee, but not so literally. And then the tea and the coffee came into place. And then let's have a coffee. No.
Yes.
Thanks, Sila.